and thank you all for standing by. At this time, I would like to inform all participants that your lines are on a listen-only mode until the question and answer portion of today's conference. Today's conference is also being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I will now turn the call over to Mr. Benjamin Haynes. Sir, you may begin.
Thank you, Christy, and thank you all for joining us today. We are joined by CDC Principal Deputy Director, Dr. Nirav Shah, and Dr. Brendan Jackson, the head of CDC's COVID-19 response, who will talk about how to end the COVID-19 PHE, or sorry, on how the end of the COVID-19 PHE will affect CDC. This information will also be detailed in two MMWRs we are releasing tomorrow. Dr. Shah and Jackson will provide remarks and then take your questions. I would also like to note that this briefing is embargoed until Friday, May 5th at 11 a.m. Eastern, when the report goes live on the CDC website. I'll now turn the call over to Dr. Shah.
Great. Thank you, Ben, and good afternoon, everyone. Thank you all for joining today. I'm speaking with you from Atlanta, where our CDC family suffered a terrible loss in yesterday's shooting. Our hearts are with our colleagues as friends, families, and coworkers. I will start today by highlighting four aspects of our changing approach to COVID-19 and then turn things over to Dr. Jackson. First, although next week marks the end of the public health emergency, it is not the end of COVID-19. COVID-19 remains a risk, and CDC remains committed to preventing severe illness and death associated with COVID-19, particularly for those who are at higher risk. This includes older Americans, people who are immune compromised, and those who are living with disabilities. Second, we have the right data for this phase of COVID-19. Though our data going forward will be different, they will continue to provide timely insights for CDC, for local health officials, as well as for the public to understand COVID-19 dynamics at the community level. There are two important points about these metrics. First, we will continue to keep our eye on the COVID-19 ball, and we will do so through a multitude of metrics. Indeed, our epidemiological understanding of COVID-19 after the end of the public health emergency will be deeper than what we have for other viruses like RSV and influenza. Second, the specifics of some metrics are changing, but the key insights remain intact. For example, our COVID-19 community levels rely in part on aggregate case rates, and those case rates may not be reported to CDC by jurisdictions after the end of the public health emergency. However, the replacement, based solely on hospital admission data, will be a strong indicator of COVID-19 status at the local level. CDC scientists have back-tested this, and as noted in the forthcoming MMWR, since February of 2022, there has been a 99% concordance between the CCLs, the community levels, which are being retired, and the new hospital admission-driven metrics. In short, we will still be able to tell that it's snowing, even though we're no longer counting every snowflake. Third, the changes that we're discussing today are happening because the end of the public health emergency means that CDC will have less authority to collect certain types of public health data. That means less data will be available to us. That said, we will have good sight lines into COVID-19, and that's because at this stage, there is not one single metric of the moment. Instead, we will continue to use a multitude of metrics to understand how COVID-19 is unfolding. And those exist on a continuum. Some metrics rise earlier and are more sensitive. Some rise later and are more specific. But the broad panoply of metrics that we will use will continue. That includes wastewater testing, emergency department diagnoses, laboratory testing for positivity rates, as well as hospital admission data. All told, these will continue to give us a full view in as timely a manner as possible. And fourth, as I've mentioned, our data at this juncture are fit for the purpose ahead. but that does not mean the work to modernize our data architecture is done. Far from it. Simply put, our ability to detect and monitor disease threats should be better in the future than it has been in the past. And that ability to detect and monitor should be built into our baseline, not contingent upon emergency declarations. For example, in the next pandemic, we shouldn't wait 6 months to have complete hospitalization data. We shouldn't need dozens of data use agreements to understand the demographics of who's getting vaccinated. We should have access to robust data before a pandemic. We should be ready so we don't have to get ready. That is the work ahead of us and the work we are committed to doing. Now, I'd like to turn things over to Dr. Jackson.
Thank you, Dr. Shah. I'm going to go into a bit more detail about how we're shifting our COVID-19 data strategy as the PHE declaration comes to an end. As Dr. Shah mentioned, data on hospitalizations will continue to be reported from all hospitals nationwide, though on a different cadence, moving from daily to weekly. This reporting will continue to provide a detailed, stable look at trends down to the county level. Hospital admissions will serve as our primary surveillance metric for COVID-19. Now, while hospitalizations provide the best national-level view of COVID trends, there are also metrics that provide earlier signals of change in COVID activity. First, CDC reports emergency department visits for COVID-19 on our COVID data tracker website down to the state level. This is a key early indicator of evolving trends. Second, wastewater testing, performed at hundreds of sites nationwide and covering nearly 140 million people, is also a good early indicator in areas where it is available. Third, later this month, we'll shift our source for test positivity data to a longstanding system called the National Respiratory and Enteric Virus Surveillance System, which is based on voluntary reporting from over 450 laboratories nationwide. So that's early indicators. Moving on to death data, we're still going to be collecting data on deaths, but with a change that improves data quality. We'll be switching our main method for tracking deaths to CDC's national system based on death certificates, which has become much timelier over the course of the pandemic. Next, let's talk about vaccination data. Dr. Shah already mentioned the data use agreements. Most jurisdictions have signed an extension to their data use agreements with CDC and will continue to share COVID-19 vaccine data even after the end of the PHE. We'll also track COVID vaccination data through vaccine coverage surveys like we do for other vaccines. Vaccine effectiveness platforms such as Ivy and Vision will continue to provide real-world data on how well protection from vaccines is holding up. Now let's talk about case data. As the pandemic has progressed, case data have become less reliable because of increases in home testing, as you all know, the results of which are often not reported. An increase in mild and asymptomatic infections have further decreased testing rates. Also, once the PHE expires, some jurisdictions may lose the authority to collect COVID-19 case data at all. These factors, coupled with a shift in focus towards tracking severe COVID-19 rather than counting infections, is leading us to remove case data as a primary metric on COVID data tracker beginning May 11th. Finally, let's talk about two implications of these changes. One, as Dr. Shah mentioned, COVID-19 community levels, or CCLs, which are used to guide individual and community actions, will be discontinued since they rely on those case data in part. That said, this change, again, is not as big a deal as it might sound, since they'll be replaced by these hospital admission levels, which were, again, the main driver of the community levels. Again, with that 99% concordance since they were established between the two. CDC will continue to use these levels to provide prevention recommendations that people, especially those at higher risk of severe COVID-19, can use to determine how best to protect themselves. Now, the second key implication of the data changes is that COVID-19 transmission levels, which are different from the COVID community levels, these transmission levels can no longer be calculated and will also be discontinued since they're based on case and county-level test positivity data. These levels have mainly been used in healthcare settings to inform source control or masking, as well as to inform admission testing in nursing homes. Because of this change, CDC is updating its infection prevention and control recommendations to make sure that healthcare facilities have appropriate information to inform their infection control processes. Now, I want to reiterate that we're still monitoring COVID-19 intensively, even as we work to integrate COVID into the broader fight against respiratory diseases. I'll turn it back to Ben so we can take questions. Thanks.
Thank you, Dr. Jackson. Christy, we are ready to open up for questions.
Thank you. At this time, if you would like to ask a question, please unmute your phone and press star 1. Please state your name and affiliation when prompted, Again, please press star 1 to ask your question. If you need to withdraw yourself from the queue, please press star 2. One moment while we wait for questions to come in. Our first question comes from Brenda Goodman of CNN. You may ask your question.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I have a question about cases and case reporting. So it's my understanding that COVID-19 is a nationally reportable, nationally notifiable condition, rather. So does that mean that that designation goes away with the public health emergency? Or I'm not understanding why states wouldn't still have to report those numbers to the CDC.
Sure, this is Brendan. I'm happy to address that question. So it is a bit challenging to sort of follow because it is not simple because of the set of state and federal process around all of this. So the nationally notifiable designation is not something determined solely by CDC. That is done by the Council of State and Territorial Epidemiologists. That is a recommendation, but it doesn't not carry sort of any authority for required reporting. So what happens is, cases get reported to the state or other jurisdictional, you know, other jurisdictions, and then that is notified then to CDC. So that recommendation is still in place, but there are, you know, each individual state or other jurisdiction has its own rules or regulations that determines what is reportable. And some of those, in some of the jurisdictions or some of the states, those authorities will go away with the end of the public health emergency. So it is a very much a state-by-state situation.
Thanks.
Next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Alice Park of Time. Your line is open.
Thank you. I just wanted to ask, you had mentioned wastewater surveillance as something that would help fill in some of the gaps with some of the data that you might no longer be getting. Can you specify whether there's any specific additional investments in that? I know that that program doesn't cover the entire country, so can you just detail what plans are to perhaps expand that or invest more heavily in that, especially also with respect to what you said, that we wanted to be better prepared for the next pandemic?
Thanks, Alice. This is Nirav. I appreciate that question. We will get back to you with some additional numbers around where we are with respect to wastewater. But in broad strokes, wastewater surveillance testing is a part of our proposed and our current architecture for infectious disease monitoring and surveillance. As Dr. Jackson noted, right now, wastewater testing covers about 138, close to 140 million Americans, which is about 40%. From a surveillance perspective, that is a robust sample of the United States that allows us to get insights not just into COVID-19, but other infectious diseases, indeed, increasingly in some jurisdictions, non-infectious diseases as well. So wastewater is one of those early sentinel markers that we do use to understand where things go, and we intend to continue the investments that the CDC has made, particularly in partnership with state and local health departments. As to the exact numbers, we will get you those and where we intend to go.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Helen Branswell of STAT. Your line is open.
Hi, thanks for taking my question. At the beginning of your remarks, Dr. Shaw, you talked about the fact that even with the data sources that are going away, CDC will still have sort of a better picture of what is going on or more detail on what is going on with COVID than it currently has with RSV and flu. Could you give us some more granularity? What are you getting for COVID that you don't know about flu and RSV?
Sure thing, Helen. I thank you for that question, and it's great to chat. I'll sort of go through it axis by axis or category by category. So with respect to COVID, let's start with, say, lab testing. On the lab testing front, we are adding COVID into the NERV system, which currently right now gives us insight into other respiratory as well as enteric diseases. So on that axis, COVID will join the ranks of some other diseases that we have monitoring from NERVs. but there are other areas where we have more insight into COVID than we would to those other diseases. Hospitalizations are a good example of that. We will continue to receive a significant amount of data around COVID hospitalizations as compared to what we were getting before. For example, one of the categories of things that's going away with respect to COVID hospitalizations are around suspect cases. At this juncture in the pandemic, with testing so widely available, there really isn't a suspect case anymore. That core data around COVID will continue to come into CDC in a manner that it does not come in for RSV and influenza. That's one concrete example. I can tick through a couple more if you'd like, but that's one example of how we will have better insight into the dynamics of COVID as compared to RSV and influenza.
Thank you.
Next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Rob Stein of NPR. Your line is open.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my question. Another question about hospital data. What data are you going to be – can you give us a little bit more specifics about data you're giving up? For example, are you going to still be able to be collecting data on race and ethnicity, for example? And then I was also wondering about do you still think you'll be getting enough data to do genomic surveillance, adequate genomic surveillance?
Hi, Rob. Happy to take that question. This is Brendan Jackson. On the first question about hospitalization data, so there's two key sources that we're using for hospitalization. The one is what we get through our National Healthcare Safety Network, or NHSN. Those are really aggregate, like total counts that we're getting from hospitals currently on a daily basis, then moving to a weekly basis. That does not include sort of detailed demographic data on each of the patients that are hospitalized. But what we have secondarily to that is a sentinel surveillance system called COVIDNet, which includes 14 sites across the country, about 10% of the U.S. population. And that will continue to collect detailed granular data on those patients, including race, ethnicity, but, I mean, going very deep into underlying medical conditions, the level of care that they're receiving, et cetera. On the genomic piece, that is absolutely going to continue. There's certainly been a decline in the number of amount of testing that's going on and specimens that are able to be submitted for genomic sequencing. So we may need to scale back on the frequency of how often we're reporting on those. But we absolutely are going to be continuing to monitor that very closely. And I'll say not only do we have sort of national genomic sequencing picture that's going on, but we also have, you know, this ongoing genomic sequencing of incoming travelers from international destinations coming to the United States, and so we're getting a look at what variants are coming to the U.S. It's been a very helpful early indicator of what might be seen in other countries, especially when those countries don't have as much sequencing. And we also have a small amount of sequencing that's happening in wastewater. That's still more in pilot phase, but it's at least helpful to get some sense of how well that's working and another way to sort of triangulate what variants are out there.
Rob, this is Nirav. I wanted to connect your question with Helen's question previously because those are additional examples of ways in which we will have good insight into COVID in a manner that's superior to what we have for flu and RSV. So genomic sequencing, although there is some that occurs with flu and RSV, there will be significantly more with COVID, similarly around hospitalization data where we'll have far better insights. And the same with wastewater and genomic as well. Over.
Next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Mike Stobie of AP. Your line is open.
Hi, thank you for taking my question. I wanted to, if you could give me just a few more specifics about the data use agreements that are in place and not in place for vaccination data. And if I could also ask, could you say a little bit more regarding Rob Stein's question about what might be lost in race and ethnicity data? And could you walk me and my readers, our readers, through we talk about the community levels. I mean, how's it going to work in the future? Like, what if the pandemic takes a turn for the worse, either because of a new variant or something else? What is the CDC going to point to? What data is it going to point to and say, hey, things in Arkansas are getting worse. You need to mask. You need a vaccine. How is that type of thing going to play out in the future? Thank you.
Thanks, Mike. I'm going to turn it to Brendan to discuss the DUAs and the racial and ethnicity data. I'll pick it up on the backside.
Absolutely. So on the data use agreements for the vaccine administration data, right now there's almost all of the jurisdictions, and there's 64 jurisdictions, you know, 50 states plus additional ones have signed these data use agreements. There may be a couple that are not able to because of their own individual state laws. So we will have a pretty comprehensive look at what vaccine administration data is like. I will say that there are challenges to those data because at the federal level, we cannot crosswalk those data between jurisdictions, between states. And there's a number of other specific challenges with that, but we'll still have that line of sight. The other piece is that we will have these vaccine coverage surveys like the National Immunization Survey that's going to collect, that's where we get most of our solid race ethnicity information going forward when it comes to vaccines and some other sources. Broadening that out on race ethnicity data in general, there's still going to be quite a number of data sources that are going to be collecting that. So we don't anticipate any sizable loss in ability to track those disparities or otherwise.
And then, Mike, to answer your question of how we will know when a situation is getting more significant in any particular jurisdiction, and I sort of think about this on a continuum of data points, but And those are the ones that we will continue to be putting on our website. So, for example, if in a particular jurisdiction we saw an increase in wastewater in a particular area, that's an early sentinel indicator of potential increases in things like cases. Now, I'm going to dive into this for a quick second. Dr. Jackson can go deeper. But what we are not going to be receiving is aggregate case data. However, because many jurisdictions will still be reporting in because, as we noted earlier, it's still notifiable, we will still have line-level data available on our website at data.cdc.gov. So that'll be another indicator that we could use to the extent that states are reporting it. Then we'll have the constellation of laboratories from the NERVS system that Dr. Jackson noted. This is over 400 or about 450 laboratories across the country that give us insight from a surveillance perspective of the volume of testing as well as increases in positivity. Next, we've got the emergency department visits. This isn't just people who are visiting. This is people who are going to the emergency department and getting diagnosed with COVID in the ED. And then finally, we would have an indicator around hospitalizations. Who's getting hospitalized, whether they're ending up in the ICU. We also couple that with the improvements in the death system, the death reporting system, which is far more timely now than it was before. All of those factors, when taken in toto, give us an insight into what's happening at a local or jurisdictional level.
Next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Lena Sun of The Washington Post. Your line is open.
Hi, thank you for taking this question. Dr. Jackson, maybe you know, I was just curious on the voluntary data use agreements. How long does it typically take to work out, do that workaround with a state? And then secondly, a lot of this information is changing. There's been a lot of different information from the CDC and FDA on vaccine recommendations. At what point is CDC going to be updating its guidance across the board so that it's in sync with everything that's going on? Thanks.
Sure, absolutely. So on the data use agreement piece, it really is dependent on the state, right? I mean, they're sort of, we say you've seen one state health department, there are, you know, legal processes that they've all got to go through. So I think the fact that we don't have a sort of a standing mechanism for this and we have to go through these individual DUAs, it definitely is a challenge. I would say this often can take in the range of weeks to months, depending on how things end up going.
I will mention a particular state health department in New England that was extremely efficient and very easy to work with.
Okay. Can't imagine which one that would be, but okay. And then on the vaccine recommendations piece, you know, there's been a lot to sort out. I think, as you know, there's been some additional updates to the emergency use authorizations related to immunocompromised children. So we have updated the interim clinical considerations for clinicians when it comes to vaccine recommendations. We've also updated our up-to-date page, and the other pages should be coming shortly, hopefully as we speak, but, you know, definitely in the next, as soon as possible is the right answer. Thanks.
Next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Hillary Brick of The Insider. Your line is open.
Hi. Yeah, thanks for doing this. My question is a little bit similar to what Helen asked earlier, but, you know, you talked about being ready for the next threat and the new tools you've developed during the COVID outbreak. I'm curious, you know, what's different, if anything, about the type of surveillance you're doing now for things like influenza because of what you've implemented for COVID? And, you know, do you think that this would help you recognize a new threat faster than before? Can you talk a little bit about the future?
Yes, absolutely. I'm really glad you raised that. While we are confident in the data that we have with respect to COVID going forward, as you heard me note and discuss with Helen, in many respects, those data are more insightful than what we currently have for RSV and influenza. That should not be taken to mean that we're good with RSV and influenza. Our entire public health data strategy and our data modernization initiative are designed to lift up those other diseases to where we currently are with respect to COVID. So, for example, I'll just give you one example of that. Around vaccination coverage, right? We still will receive weekly feeds from jurisdictions around ongoing COVID vaccination. But with respect to influenza and RSV, with the flu, we receive that at best quarterly, in addition to some other surveys we do. And for RSV, of course, there's not a vaccine. But that's an example where we'd like to lift up the insights and the surveillance approach to other infectious diseases rather than resting on our laurels with respect to COVID. And that's what I meant about the work ahead of us.
Christy, we have time for two more questions.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Spencer Kimball of CNBC. Your line is open.
Hi, thank you. Can you just walk me through what will be visible on the COVID data tracker after May 11th? I mean, my understanding from reading this and what you all have said is that weekly case data and weekly death data will not be visible, and it'll primarily be hospitalization data. And with the death data, with that transitioning to, you know, a new authority responsible for it, how often will death data be reported in the future? Thank you.
Sure, happy to take that. This is Brendan Jackson. So our two main indicators at the top are going to be hospitalizations and deaths. Both are going to continue to be available on a weekly update schedule. So, and I will note there'll be a slight change with the death data, how that's reported. I think it's important to note the way we've been getting it in the aggregate death data, and in the same way a lot of news sources have been scraping it from state websites, we've been doing that, but plus we have direct data feeds from the jurisdictions. Those are generally based on date of report, not the actual date of death. What we're switching to now is actually a more stable form where it's actually going to be reporting based on the date of death. So I think that you'll note that there's the data, you know, the death data that we've had can be kind of spiky, right? There's can be batched reporting and those type of issues. Moving to this death certificate-based format should smooth that out, and we'll see it better. What that means, though, is in the past week, we had sort of a false sense of where things were because it was based on date of report. In the past week, it's going to be based on date of death. We got a new metric that goes there that is the percent of all deaths that have been reported for that week that are caused by COVID. And what this does is this gets it sort of addresses the problem where, you know, deaths can sort of come in and get reported at slightly different times, and that addresses for that. When you look backwards from there, you'll still get the total number of deaths as they fill in. But definitely we're still going to have those data. It's just going to look a little bit different in terms of how those are displayed. And you'll still be able to see the number of deaths that have been reported for the last week, just understanding those are still going to be incomplete for a couple weeks while those data fill in. In addition to hospitalization and deaths, we're going to have emergency department visits. Are going to be displayed more prominently. Wastewater data will still be there. And then in a couple weeks, we're going to have that new NERVS system for test positivity as the national test positivity system comes away. A number of other data sources that we're still going to have there, genomic surveillance, all the traveler-based genomic surveillance, wastewater genomic surveillance. Like, there's a lot of other stuff that's still going to be there. Really, the main changes are going to be the case data no longer displayed as prominently. But again, the line-level case data that Dr. Shaw mentioned will still be there in terms of the demographics, at least for a while until we move that to a different site. And then the national-level test positivity in terms of the COVID electronic lab reporting, or CELR, system is going away to be replaced by the NERV system. Anything you'd like to add, Dr. Shaw? I think we're good. Thanks.
Our last question, please.
Thank you. Our last question comes from Alexander Tin of CBS News. Your line is open.
Hi, thanks for doing this. I just had three things I was hoping maybe Dr. Jackson could clarify. So is the plan to have new specific thresholds from this metric on when the general population is recommended to take precautions like masking, or will there no longer be those thresholds? Will source control in healthcare settings be tied to this new metric? And is both this new metric and the guidance ready to go tomorrow? Thanks so much.
Sure, absolutely. Happy to take those. So essentially, the COVID community levels, which are, again, targeted at, you know, the public and individuals, those are basically going to remain largely intact, just switching to the COVID hospital admission levels. I'll point out that right now, you know, 99%+ of the population is in a low community level, and that would be basically the same for these new hospital admission levels. We understand that there's going to be a mix of uptake in this, and the uptake may be low in some areas, but we feel it's important to put out there that when things get to a high level, and when hospitalizations, if they do, we don't know if they will in large part, but get to those high community levels now, the hospital admission levels, there will be a recommendation at least for people to wear masks. To the second question, for the healthcare infection prevention and control guidance and the source control masking, at a minimum, the recommendation is for healthcare facilities to recommend facility-wide masking when it's recommended in the community, so following those same levels that we just discussed for the public. There will be additional recommendations for when facilities may wish to also implement either sort of unit-wide or facility-wide masking recommendations based on the type of patients that they're caring for. You know, are they a higher-risk patient group versus a lower-risk patient group? And also sort of the broader picture, what's happening in their facility, whether they're having a facility-based outbreak. And also, this is sort of tying back to, like, you know, pre-existing, pre-pandemic infection control guidance that has already been in place, which is if you're seeing lots of respiratory disease in the community, whether it's COVID or something else, like flu or RSV, that might be a time to also put in place sort of masking recommendations for the facility. And in terms of the timing, I will defer to others on the exact timing of that. I don't believe it'll go ahead tomorrow, but it'll be coming quite soon, within the next week. And I just wanted to add one point to the previous question about what's going to be on COVID data tracker. Vaccine administration data will still be present on COVID data tracker. There will be a later pivot to focusing more on sort of the vaccine coverage data, but vaccine data will absolutely continue to be on COVID data tracker. Thanks.
Great. Before we adjourn for the afternoon, I wanted to just offer two clarifying points based on the discussion that we've just had. The first is around the hospital reporting data, what we will continue to retain versus what may go by the wayside or what will go by the wayside. Much of what will go by the wayside, or one example of that, is around suspect cases. Suspect cases were instituted to be reported early on in the process, early on in the pandemic. This was in an era when testing was scarce, and we needed to have a sense of how many people were coming into the hospital who likely had COVID, but we weren't sure because of a lack of testing. And, of course, now testing is plentiful, and thus the concept of a suspect case is a difficult thing for a hospital to ascertain. It requires someone to go around and figure out what's going on there, and it's not something that adds a lot of data or value to our understanding of COVID. That's an example of what's going away on the hospital front. Second clarifying question, there's some discussion around our views around how we understand COVID relative to other respiratory infectious diseases. And for clarity around that, I wanted to go through just a couple of the axes, a couple of the examples of where, with respect to COVID, we will have superior insight relative to RSV and influenza. Cases. We will continue to get some degree of case reporting, and those will be on our website for COVID in a manner that we don't for RSV and influenza. Death reporting. We will continue to have improved death reporting data, as Dr. Jackson has noted. Test positivity, we are on equal footing there. The hospitalizations are key. As we've discussed, we will continue to have national hospitalization reports for COVID, whereas right now for RSV and flu, those only exist on a sentinel basis. We've already talked about wastewater, where we will have robust wastewater covering about 40% of Americans, whereas for RSV and flu, they are limited. Same with genomic surveillance, where we will have several-fold more surveillance for genomic variants for COVID than we do with respect to the other diseases. So those are just some clarifying examples for where we are right now. To close, again, our mission ahead of us is to lift all of those up to the same plateau that COVID is on right now, and that's the work we're committed to doing. Thank you. I'll turn it back to Ben.
Thank you, Dr. Shaw and Jackson, for joining us today. And to all the reporters, thank you for your participation. I want to remind you that today's briefing is embargoed until tomorrow, May 5th at 11 a.m. Eastern, when the report goes live on the CDC website. If you have follow-up questions, please call the main press office at 404-639-3286, or you can email media@cdc.gov. Thank you. This will conclude our call.
Thank you. That does conclude today's conference. You may disconnect at this time. Thank you and have a good day.